Hi, friends. How are we doing? Well, I'm glad you're here today. We're continuing a series we're calling Nothing to Fear. In this series, we're looking at biblical characters as case studies of how to face our fears. As we've seen through this series, some did so more valiantly than others. But in today's case study, we examine the well-known story of a guy who got it right. He faced his fears with faith. But to understand his story and apply it to our lives, we as readers have to look carefully to see where he places his faith. Before we come to today's case study, let's invite God to speak to us. Will you pray with me? Lord, as we come to a story we've read again and again and again and again, I pray you bring fresh revelation from familiar narration. I pray that you take a passage of the Bible many of us have heard as children, and from it, help us find that childlike faith we need to thrive in any and every circumstance. For my friends who face uncertainty, may you meet them here in this story. For my friends who are burdened or discouraged, may they find your presence and power as we unpack these powerful words of Scripture. We pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. Today, I would like to begin by sharing with you one of the most important things on the internet. It is the band Scary Pockets. Any of you ever heard of Scary Pockets? Anyone? Okay, five services. I don't know how many people we had this weekend. One person raised their hand. And I had sent her a link to Scary Pockets myself, and that's the only reason she'd heard of Scary Pockets. But let me introduce you to Scary Pockets. Scary Pockets is a funk band founded by Ryan Lehrman and Jack Conte, two incredible musicians. They're joined by a rotating roster of the best session musicians from the Los Angeles area. They record funk versions of pop tunes and release a new recording every Monday on YouTube. Here's a song that may sound familiar to you.
Here some bad news with us and there.
This is guest vocalist Paul McDonald. That's Ryan. That's Sam Wilkes on bass. Watch for his head bop in a moment. He said that drum was lighting up. It's a natural occurring phenomenon when funk is played properly. There's the head bop. Look at that. Oh, yeah. Feel it? This is what happens when funk comes to a room like this. Okay, here's one. Here's another example of Scary Pockets. Go ahead, guys. This, my friends, is Charles Jones on vocals and piano, and he feels good. And that makes me feel good. And watch for Sam's head bop. Watch it. It's like a bobblehead. Look at that. Oh, yeah. And look at how Ryan and Jack looking at each other with a smile. When they smile like that, that means a funk miracle is about to happen. Watch it. Uh-oh. Watch it. Here it comes. Oh, yeah. It's getting a little funky. But we're going to have to cut this piano solo short because it's just too funky and you can't handle the funk. How about this classic? Good news. Charles is back.
When the night has come.
And he's looking right into your soul. Just receive this, okay? He's singing to you. Look at Jack's face. The groove's getting gritty. Look out. I don't know what he's wearing around his neck, but I want one. I see Jack's on his feet. When you have to stand to play a Wurlitzer, that's how you know the funk waters are rising. Okay, here's one more. Oh, friends. We're no strangers. I'm taking you back to the 80s. To love. You know the Does anybody rules. Remember so Rick Astley? For commitment, this is Reeve Carney on the vocals.
You wouldn't get this from any other
Listen
guy.
To that control.
Tell you
that gentle
how
intensity.
I got to make you understand. I'm never gonna get you.
I would dress like him if I could sing like him. You really open shirt and all. You'd be fine with it as long as I had that voice.
And you. Never gonna make you cry. Never gonna say.
You just got rickrolled and it's never felt so good. Okay, what do you think? Now, there are many more videos online. And there are two reasons Scary Pockets videos work. First, unsurpassed musicianship. These folks are phenomenal. Second, and more importantly, their songs are familiar. Go to YouTube and see for yourself. You'll scroll through their list and you'll find loads of songs that you've heard on the radio, maybe for decades. And there's a power that comes with familiarity. Today, we will examine one of the most familiar stories in human history, the story of David and Goliath. His great book on David called Leap Over a Wall, the late Eugene Peterson, offers his observations of the story's familiarity. And he invites us to step into the story with him. Peterson observes, "The story of David and Goliath is one of the greatest of all children's stories. It's the first full-blown story about David and the most memorable. If you know anything at all about David, you know the story of Goliath. People who've never read the Bible, people who've never so much as heard that there is a Bible, know the story of David and Goliath. But once we've learned the story and assimilated the meaning that goes with it, the story isn't over and done with. Learning stories isn't the same as learning the multiplication tables. Once we've learned that 3 times 4 equals 12, we've learned it and that's that. It's a fact that doesn't change. The data is stored in our memory for ready access. But stories don't stay put. They grow and deepen. The meaning doesn't exactly change, but it matures. Having learned the meaning of love, for instance, we don't for a moment suppose that we've passed that course and can now go on to other things, deciding perhaps to sign up for computer science. No, we keep on telling stories, the same old ones, over and over and over again. In a way quite different from saying the multiplication tables over and over again. The stories keep releasing new insight in new situations. As we bring new experience and insight to the story gathers that enrichment in and gives it back to us in a fresh form. And so it turns out that the David and Goliath story is as important for adults as it ever was for children. Friends, today we're going to talk about trust. And I'm going to invite you to identify where you've placed your trust. Because you may not trust what you think you trust. I love teaching about trust. It's a recurring theme in the scriptures. It's a recurring theme in my sermons. Now, as I identify trust as a motif in my messages, I don't want to give you the impression that I'm any good at it, because I'm still learning. There are certain segments of the journey with Jesus in which I excel at trust. For me, when utter calamity strikes, I'm as cool as a cucumber. If life is coming undone, I find hope and strength knowing I'm in God's hands. But ironically, my lack of faith lurks in the day-to-day, the week-to-week struggles of deadlines and to-do lists. I race about as if God's given me too many assignments, but too little time. Well, if you dug deep enough into my soul, you'd find that is due to a lack of trust, or more accurately, misplaced trust. Most of you know I've been heavily influenced by the life and leadership of Dallas Willard. Before he passed away, Dr. Willard served for many decades as the professor of philosophy at USC, but he's best known for his understanding of the teaching of Jesus. I quote Dallas Willard all the time. I talk about him almost as much as I talk about food. But there's a particular piece of Dallas's advice that shaped my journey with Jesus more than almost everything else he said. Don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God. Don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God. Now, I've shared this with you before, but it bears repeating, because this humble statement explains 98% of my soul's anguish. Don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God. The story of David we'll examine today shows us these paths in contrast. We'll begin by reading in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Socah and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. King Saul leads the armies of Israel to face the Philistines. The purpose of the battle was to obtain control of the valley of Elah. The valley of Elah was the entry point between the two kingdoms. Securing this valley guaranteed strategic advantage to the conquering country. Now, earlier in 1 Samuel, we could discover the primary reason the Israelites wanted a king in the first place was to defeat the Philistines. Well, that plan doesn't appear to be working. Verse 4, a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. Now, the Hebrew word here translated champion is more literally man of the between. That'll make more sense shortly. Our narrative informs us, verse 4, his height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, a cubit is not a precise measurement. A cubit is the distance between the elbow and the tip of the middle finger, which is about 18 inches. A span is the distance between the tip of the thumb and the tip of the little finger when a hand is spread out, about 9 inches. The New International Version footnote tells us that is about 9 feet, 9 inches, or 3 meters. That's one tall man. Some ancient translations lower the number. Some versions of the Greek translation called the Septuagint reduce the number to 4 cubits in a span, making him 6'6". Now, there's no way to know for sure how tall Goliath was, but the size of his armor and weaponry, which will be described in a moment, lean toward the reading of the traditional Hebrew text. This guy's really tall. Both ancient and modern history attest to gigantism, which we know today is a dysfunction of the pituitary gland that causes someone to grow beyond normal size. It's a big man. The author adds, verse 5, he had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels. Now, often when we read Old Testament narratives, the writers give terse descriptions of characters. But this writer patiently describes this hulk of a man in greater detail than perhaps any other text in the Bible. He says Goliath is armed to the teeth, an exotic battle dress. His breastplate alone weighs 5,000 shekels, which is about 125 pounds. That's like going into battle with a person strapped to your chest. Verse 6, On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung in his back. The greaves covered his calves, while the javelin was probably a scimitar from East Asia. Verse 7, his spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. The spear is compared to a weaver's beam, which means it was very thick. The tip of the spear, called the flame, was made of iron and weighed 600 shekels, which is about 15 pounds. A cord was attached to the spear, which allowed a skilled thrower to hurl it with a spin, letting it fly further, faster. And the shield carried by a shield bearer was of the type that covered his entire body. Needless to say, Goliath is an intimidating figure. Verse 8, Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not the servants of Saul?" He says, "Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Both people groups believed that warfare was first and foremost a contest between their gods. So why not avoid senseless bloodshed by conducting a contest of champions? This practice was not unheard of in the ancient Near East. I noted earlier that word champion meant a man of the between, referring to the space between the two armies. He's the middleman. He's the intermediary who would represent his people. Goliath offers the army of Saul a challenge. "Send out a man and we'll make this easy." But no one from Saul's army responds. In fact, we read verse 10, that the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now, the Israelite army is outmatched to begin with. Modern archaeological excavations have shown that the Philistines were an advanced society. Their work with iron was particularly noteworthy. They were especially gifted blacksmiths, which was a skill not yet mastered by Israel. That means these iron workers probably came to battle with better weapons. No wonder our narrator tells us the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Dismayed is the word chatat in Hebrew, which conveys a dire condition. Literally, the word means something like shattered. Saul and his army, in fact, his whole army, the text says, are utterly dismayed and frozen in terror. We often see those two words paired together in the Hebrew Bible, dismayed and terrified. You know, we often experience them together in everyday life too, don't we? I bet more than a few of you are facing a giant-sized crisis right now. Maybe you're in financial trouble. You've prayed every prayer. You've done everything you can do. But right now, you face a very uncertain tomorrow. Maybe you realize you're in an unhealthy relationship, but you're afraid to break it up with them because he may be your last shot at marriage. You're frozen and indecision. You're dismayed and terrified. And have you noticed? Fear is contagious. We pass it along from friend to friend, from parent to child. We pass on our fear of failure, our fear of growing old, our fear of disapproval. The fear of King Saul spreads among the soldiers. But then the narrative shifts abruptly, about 15 miles eastward. Verse 12. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to war. The first one was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shema. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. Now, if you know David's story, you know David was already anointed king of Israel by Samuel instead of his brothers. But David is still not treated like Jesse's other sons, probably because he's so young. Verse 16. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. Now, hold on a second. I thought we were back east in Bethlehem, and the writer toggles right back to the battlefield. That's because the author does not want us to forget what is going on out west. Concurrently, Goliath's taunts continue to twist to twice a day for well over a month. And as each day passes, the Israelite army becomes more discouraged. Every word from the mouth of the warrior leaves them petrified in their tents, utterly hopeless. Maybe you've been staring your giant in the face for so long, your hope is ebbing away too. But whether you realize it or not, you're making a choice in your response to your crisis. You're making a decision to respond either in fear or in faith. King Saul is overwhelmed by the size of his foe. He's shaken to his core. His imagination has become so filled up with the Philistine warrior, there's no room for God. He lies awake at night, awaiting the booming voice of Goliath. The next morning, Saul's living in dread. Back to David, verse 17. Now, Jesse said to his son David, "Take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp." You could tell Jesse's worried because he tells his youngest to hurry. Verse 18. "Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them." Assurance refers to some kind of token or pledge, something that visibly assures the father that his boys are all right. Well, David will bring something back to show Papa. It's just not what Jesse's expecting. The father explains, verse 19, "They," meaning David's brothers, "are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah, fighting against the Philistines." Jesse's words are probably intended to put David in this place again, reminding him he's too young to fight with the king. Verse 20. "So early in the morning, David left the flock in the care of a shepherd, loaded up, and set out as Jesse had directed." Now, I want you to notice through this passage how God uses everyday circumstances to get his man in the right place at the right time to accomplish his plan. Jesse gives an order, but God works through that order. After David travels about 15 miles west, verse 20, he reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines, facing each other. The narrator's words in Hebrew carefully call attention to God's perfect timing. David arrives just as they go out. Verse 22. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brothers how they were. As he was talking to them, note again the timing of God. Every moment seems carefully orchestrated. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance. And David heard it. Verse 24. "Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear." It's the same word translated terror in verse 11. See, apparently, over these 40 days, the cowardly king of Israel has been searching without success for a champion among his troops. As the psychological warfare continues, Saul apparently sweetens the deal. Verse 25, now the Israelites have been saying, "Do you see how the man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." Hey, do you think Jesse would like one of his boys to bring that home from the battlefield? The tax exemption would cover father and brothers as well as slaves and laborers. It could cover as many as 50 to 100 people. This is the talk amongst the soldiers. But David hasn't heard it yet. So verse 26, David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Okay, not until this moment has anyone even mentioned God. It's as if the faith of the Israelites has evaporated. David and the soldiers are looking at the same situation differently. The soldiers referred to Goliath as this man who defies Israel. David sees him as an uncircumcised Philistine who dares to defy the armies of the living God. David sees this as a deeply theological problem. He's indignant that someone would profane God's name in that way. Elohim Chaim, the living God. The God of Israel is alive. Unlike the gods of the Philistines, those lifeless idols that they put their trust in. Question. Are you worrying like there's no God in heaven? Waiting for a job? Waiting for a spouse? Are you waiting with anticipation or agnosticism? Verse 27. They repeated to him what they'd been saying and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. Now a boy, perhaps a teenager, asks the most courageous question heard in the camp in 40 days. But look how his brother responds. Verse 28. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Verse 29. Now what have I done? Said David. Can I even speak? He says, well, excuse me. Verse 30. He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter. And the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul. And Saul sent for him. Verse 32. David said to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. David tries to encourage King Saul. But how much courage could King Saul draw from the words of a hobbit? Verse 33, Saul replied, you are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth. Now, this is a sensible response, right? At least from a person who sees power and prowess through the eyes of the world. Saul's words are emphatic. You are only a boy. He is a man of war. In comparison, David's just a pop. Verse 34. But David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Lions and bears were common in the region at this time period. Literally, David says, I seized it by the beard. Picture a young shepherd grasping a lion by its mane. Verse 36. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. Bold words. But in case there's any confusion about who conquered those wild beasts, young David clarifies, verse 37, the Lord, who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine. Now notice the balance of David's belief. Yes, David rescued the lamb, but God rescued David, and David trusted God would do it again. You see, there's something beyond self-confidence here. His courage is rooted in faith. It's our first glimpse of the contrast between David and Saul. Somewhere along the way, David learned, don't trust your best, do your best and trust God. Don't trust your best, do your best and trust God. Absolutely. Give life your best. Throw yourself into your career. Work hard, play hard, plan hard. You owe it to yourself and you owe it to God. Colossians 3:23 says, whatever you do, do it with all your heart. Give it your all. Just don't trust your all. Verse 37. Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. There it is. We've seen some variant of this phrase in every passage we've studied in our series on fear. The Lord is with you. Friends, this is the most beautiful thing you or I could experience along this journey of life. A sense that God's with us. Wherever we go, whatever we're doing, whatever comes our way. How differently would you respond to the circumstances of life if you were confident that God was with you? By the way, are you surprised that little David convinces Saul to let him fight Goliath? I mean, remember what happens if David wins or if David loses. If David loses, Saul submits to the Philistines and Israel's enslaved again. Oh, the stakes are high. Tell me, how in the world did this kid convince this king to let him become Israel's representative warrior? Well, earlier I said fear is contagious. So is faith. Verse 38. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. The king's armor is surely the finest armor Israel has to offer. And Saul wants to provide David with every possible hope of success. Saul's helmet is made of bronze, same material as Goliath's helmet, which was probably not worn by many soldiers in Israel. Wooden, a bronze helmet offered David the best protection in such circumstances. Verse 39, David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. In 1 Samuel 9, Saul is described as being a head taller than everyone else in Israel. In 1 Samuel 16, our narrator clearly implies David was the runt of the litter. We are intended to see the humor of this scene. Verse 39, I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. Verse 40, then he took his staff in his hand, chose five smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in hand, approached the Philistine. David walks to the riverbed and selects five smooth stones. And those stones are courage, faith, integrity. If you're not catching on, I'm absolutely kidding. It's an inside joke if you've been in Capitol for a while. Look, I think too much has been made of those five smooth stones over the years. But when you read 1 Samuel 17, you gotta wonder, why five? I don't see deep significance in the number, but I think it's safe to say David wasn't sure how this thing would shake out. He wasn't sure it'd be over in one shot. Perhaps the five smooth stones are an example of David doing his best without trusting his best. Hey, he's working from experience here. The lion turned on him after being struck with the stone. Goliath is likely to do the same. So David brings a few extra. Why not 10 stones? Well, David probably surmised if the job wasn't done in five, he'd be done in five. So five will have to do. Verse 41. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. As Goliath inches closer, he looks down on young David with hatred. He's especially incensed because David's a pretty boy who just put on his shoes and socks. Verse 43, he said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Dogs, by the way, were not highly regarded in their world. People didn't dress them in little sweater vests. And cursing David by his gods, we see the ancient way of calling for a god's help, invoking that god's power. Verse 44, "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." This is what you might call ancient Semitic trash talk. To die without burial was a despicable act of dishonor in the Near East. But this is what the Philistine promises. You want to see a cool literary element in the story? I'm not really asking for your permission because I'm just going to show you. In Hebrew, verses 41 through 44 repeat the same subject of each sentence, the Philistine. Now, the NIV doesn't preserve that effect because the translators wanted to smooth out the language in English to be true to their translational philosophy. But you'll see the effect in the English Standard Version, verse 41. and the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with the shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field." The writer repeats the subject again and again to slow down the narrative. It's a literary device that imitates the lumbering steps of the giant, contrasted with the speedy preparation of our hero. Verse 45. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." It's an emphatic declaration of trust. You come against me with a sword. I come against you with a name. Poor Goliath. David turns Goliath's curse back on him. Verse 46. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know there's a God in Israel." There are two reasons God will do this. First, he wants the whole world to know there's one God, the God of the armies of Israel. The second purpose is found in verse 47. "All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." David's people had a lesson to learn about the Lord. And some of us need to learn it as well. Don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God. The battle's the Lord's. Don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God. And over the years, I've sometimes found it hard to discern when I'm merely doing my best from when I'm actually trusting my best. And over these years, I've found for me a simple litmus test that helps me determine if I'm doing my best or trusting my best. Here it is. If I'm stressed, I'm trusting my best. Shakespeare, it ain't. But it's proven to be true to my soul. If I'm stressed, I'm trusting my best. Now, some of us wear our stress like a badge. We're proud of it. As if you should admire me for being stressed, because my stress makes me important. The fact of the matter is, my stress says less about the importance of my life and more about the impotence of my faith. Hear me, fellow driven disciples of Jesus. You don't get any points for being more stressed than the rest of us. You're just showing us you don't trust Christ enough to relax. Let's return to David's story, verse 48. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Verse 49, reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. And the author interrupts the story's flow to make an editorial comment he doesn't want us to miss. Verse 50. So David triumphed over the Philistine with the sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. Back to the valley. Verse 51. David ran and stood over it. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from its sheath. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. The Hebrew text is more ambiguous than the NIV implies. We don't know if it was the stone or the sword that killed Goliath. Either way, we can't overlook the irony of David using the Philistine's own weapon to decapitate him. Verse 51. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Apparently, the deal is off. There's no surrender for submission. The stunned Philistines flee in terror. Verse 52. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. The dead were strewn along the Sha'arim road to Gath and Ekron. And from our modern viewpoint, it's hard not to wince when we read words like this in the Old Testament. How can we celebrate so much violence? Well, just remember, the people of the ancient Near East equated military strength with the strength of their nation's deity. God spoke in David's day, in David's way. Verse 53. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. And finally, verse 54. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. He put the Philistine's weapons in his own tent. And thus ends the story of David and Goliath. Now, let's bring this story into our world. And we should be careful here, because we often get this wrong. The conventional application of the David and Goliath story is, be brave and go get them, because you got this, girl. And if you needed a self-help tip today, then I hope you got it. But some of us are beyond the help of self-help. We need something bigger than us to help us. This makes sense if you think about it. Michel Couchat says, a boat anchored to itself is not anchored at all. When we read 1 Samuel 17, the narrator intends us to see the contrast of the two kings, David and Saul. David walked in faith. Saul walked in fear. But Saul's ideal solution wasn't to simply run out and face his fear. We should seek to understand why Saul was afraid in the first place. See, Saul's fear doesn't necessarily mean that he lacked faith. It just means he put his faith in the wrong thing. Faith in the wrong thing eventually gives way to fear. Or we could say it this way. Fear comes from misplaced trust. What did Saul trust? Saul trusted physical prowess, military experience, military equipment, swords, shields, helmets. Now, faith in those things got Saul a long way in life. And faith in those things works well until it doesn't. It works well to put your faith in talent until you realize you're not the most talented. It works well to put your faith in good looks until you grow old. It works well to put your faith in your strength until you face a problem that's stronger than you. See, Saul got used to being the tallest guy in the room. Then Goliath comes along. Goliath's taller, has better weapons, greater self-esteem. But both Saul and Goliath put their faith in the wrong things. It didn't work out well for either of them. Faith in the wrong thing eventually gives way to fear if you live long enough. So let me ask, what do your fears tell you about your faith and where you've placed it? Do you fear conflict? Do you fear failure? Are you afraid to disappoint people? Are you terrified of looking stupid? What do your fears tell you about your faith? Specifically, where you've placed it. Here's my advice. Don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God. So much of our misery in life comes from the fact that we have begun to trust our best. And take account of the damage done when we live in that kind of fear. Consider how your fear of failure drives you to work ridiculous hours while your friends and family are neglected. Consider how your fear of being alone drives you into relationships with women who will draw you away from God, and you know better. Good night. You know better. Consider how your fear of disappointing others prevents you from saying no to your boss, saying no to your boyfriend, saying no to your children. All those fears point to our faith, where we've really put our faith. My advice: don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God. See what He does. Let's pray. Lord, I know many people in this room are staring down. A giant that is so much bigger than they are. I don't have a prayer. But really, that's all they have. I pray they see that's more than enough. Too many of us have been blowing and going through life, putting our trust in ourselves, our talents, our resources, our perseverance. We put our trust in that endurance that we have to work harder and longer than everyone else around us. And that sounds like a great thing to put your trust in till you get sick. Till somebody works harder. God, we've put our faith in the wrong things. No wonder we're so stressed. No wonder we're so difficult to be around. So God, I pray you help us to discern the difference between doing our best and trusting our best. And in real time, the line appears so fine, but really it's not. For a lot of us, the reason we're doing our best is simply because we're trusting our best. But what if doing our best instead could become something like an act of worship? We do our best to honor you. And you take it from there. What's your battle to begin with? Help us to see that. It's your battle to begin with. And we can rest in that. God, I pray you'd help us to apply this in those important areas of life, and work, and relationship, finance, health. And I pray for my friends who are journeying with us, who don't know you yet, but they're interested. They're asking questions. God, I pray for them. That they stay with us on this journey and keep asking questions. Give them the faith to keep asking questions and bring them to a place where they see your love and your faithfulness. And may they trust you with their whole lives. We pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Okay, can I talk to you about homework? Here's what I recommend for you this week. You read a story of David. I want to recommend a song of David, particularly Psalm 56. Now, fair warning, Psalm 56 is written in a different season of David's life. Similarly to 1 Samuel 17, David is utterly outmatched. But unlike the David of 1 Samuel 17, the David of Psalm 56 is afraid. Now, no more than a few years have passed since Goliath, but David's circumstances have utterly shifted. He's lost his support system. Life's worn him down and spread him thin. David's running for his life, not just from the armies of the Philistines. He's running from Saul and the armies of Israel. His life's coming undone. But here's why David's particularly afraid. The heading of Psalm 56 tells us David wrote this song when the Philistines had seized him at Gath. Now, who do we know who came from Gath? Goliath. Now, just a few years later, the famous giant slayer finds himself alone and apprehended by the ruler of Goliath's hometown. Think they forgot about what David did? Of course they didn't. Later in 1 Samuel 21, we read about David's emotion after hearing the taunts from the people of Gath in this season. Verse 12 says, David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. I don't think the narrator of Samuel ever mentions David's fear except when he seized at Gath. David's terrified. And David has good reason to be terrified. If his faith is in his ability to fight the king of Gath. So, when David sees his fear and he recognizes it, because half the time we don't even recognize we're afraid, we're just acting out. When David recognizes he's afraid, he does something utterly brilliant. Verse 3 of Psalm 56. When I am afraid, I put my trust in you. When David is afraid, he recognizes his trust is misplaced. He's trusting in chariots and horses. He's trusting in swords and spears. When he's stressed, he realizes, oh, I put my faith in the wrong thing. And what does David do? Somehow in his soul, he toggles his trust to God. I pray you find ways of doing that for yourself this week. Check out Psalm 56. Here's a book for the week, Leap Over a Wall by Eugene Peterson. An incredible book on the life of David. I love this book. Years ago, we worked through the life of David in a message series, and I recommended this book back then. We've picked up more copies of it. It's available at the back if you're interested. You're welcome to pick one up here. Here's a verse for the week, Psalm 56, verse 3. We read it a moment ago. When I am afraid, I put my trust in you. Friends, this is one to commit to memory. And you could pray it as kind of like this breath prayer. Right before you walk into that meeting. Right before you engage in that difficult conversation. Even if it sneaks up on you. And you're like, uh-oh, this just got real. In that moment, in your heart, when I'm afraid, I put my trust in you. Not my talent to handle a crucial conversation with excellence. I put my trust in you. This image of Psalm 56:3, along with this graphic, don't trust your best, do your best, and trust God. Both will be available for you to download from our website this afternoon. Please stand with me. Last, and absolutely least, head on over to YouTube and listen to Scary Pockets. Currently, there's 75 Scary Pockets recordings on YouTube. Number 76 will drop tomorrow morning. Oh, clearly, you have been watching all the wrong things on the internet, haven't you? Oh, seriously, you're going to hear, there's a Lady Gaga song on there. You'll cry yourself to sleep tonight listening to it. Oh, my word, the funk. And they do classics. You got Beatles tunes on there. Do we have any Cat Stevens fans? Okay, no kidding you. This gal named Rhett Madison, who's a favorite of Scary Pockets, she sings this tune of Cat Stevens. Seriously, just, it'll change your life forever. Scary Pockets. If you came with a need, there will be people here waiting at the front that are here to pray for you. Make your way up and invite them to do so. This is my prayer for all of you. I'll keep it simple. May you find a way to do your best without trusting your best, because you've put your trust in God. Thanks for coming today. Grace and peace.